Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group, was held on Tuesday, April 9th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing public ownership of law firms. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks today from each of our three experts in turn of about 6 to 10 minutes, after which we'll have some discussion, and then we'll take questions from the audience. Thomas D. Morgan is the Oppenheim Professor of Antitrust and Trade Regulation Law at the George Washington University Law School. He's also served as dean at the Emory University School of Law and on the faculties of Brigham Young University and the University of Illinois. We'll hear then next from Mr. John Thies, who is president of the Illinois State Bar Association and a shareholder at the Weber and Thies Law Firm, where he concentrates his practice in the areas of business representation and general litigation. Third, we'll hear from Francis Menton, who's a partner in the litigation department and co-chair of the Business Litigation Practice Group of Wilkie Farr & Gallagher in New York, and there he specializes in complex and technical commercial litigation. So without further, Professor Morgan, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks very much, Dean. This is an important topic, and it's a pleasure to be able to talk about it with such informed and excellent colleagues. I want to start by acknowledging that law has been traditionally seen as a personal service profession, and the private firm, owned by the lawyers engaged in their own practice at that firm, has been the model for the U.S. legal profession and has served the country well. It's tempting for lawyers who thrive under the current model to think that changing the model would unnecessarily rock the boat and put traditional assumptions in doubt about even what it means to be a lawyer. But what I'm arguing today is that there is reason that parts of the model should change, and that ownership interests in firms that provide legal services should not be limited to lawyers. The District of Columbia has recognized a form of such organization for many years, and recently both Great Britain and Australia have gone even farther to recognize that the time has come to acknowledge that organizations not exclusively owned by lawyers can make a contribution to delivering legal services. Those countries regulate such organizations as entities, not just as groups of lawyers. And they recognize that for some of the kinds of services these organizations deliver, it's important to be able to raise capital from more than the lawyers who work for the entities. I'm going to take my limited time to discuss two kinds of such service providers that should illustrate why a changed approach is necessary and desirable. First, developments in technology make the broad delivery of low-cost legal services to the middle class and even to some poor people, which has been a goal of lawyers for almost the last century. It's now possible that it can happen. Perhaps the best-known illustration, although by no means the only one, is LegalZoom.com. That company sells forms with which people can write their will, form a corporation, or do many other things that traditionally have required a lawyer. The technology allows customers to fill in answers on a questionnaire that are then converted by the computer into the documents being prepared. LegalZoom is a private company not owned exclusively by lawyers, and its investors support the technology to develop the forms and procedures that can reach a large client base. What LegalZoom and similar companies are not permitted to do today is hire lawyers to answer even simple questions about how to fill in the blanks on the questionnaire, certainly not to advise as to which form would work best in the customer's situation. That would be the unauthorized practice of law today. Likewise, without access to capital markets, it's hard for most law firms that could give such advice to develop the required technology and promote the possible service. LegalZoom is creating various cumbersome referral arrangements with lawyers to try to make its system work, and it may do so. But my point is that a legal services company that could raise the necessary capital could provide services to middle-class Americans that we lawyers have only talked about for years. We lawyers talk as though we want to solve problems, but our regulatory system, here our limitation on raising outside capital, puts roadblocks into efforts to address those problems. Second, for most of the 20th century, a partnership model served even big firm lawyers well, because most of the capital was human capital. Partners could divide the profits at the end of the year and start over the next year. For at least the last 20 years, however, as clients have become larger and worldwide in scope, their legal problems have become more complex and geographically diverse. The result has been the creation of law firms with a similar size and scope. Some of these firms have revenues measured in billions of dollars, costs that are similarly huge, and a need for management more analogous to that of the companies they serve than of traditional law partnerships. I am not arguing today that such firms are typical or even desirable, but they also are not unusual. It is not coincidental that much of the world's complex legal business is moving to London's magic circle firms that may attract funds from capital markets larger than their partners' individual credit lines. Further, in this country, we have seen firms like Dewey and Howry fail in part, and only in part, but in part because of bad financial management and a bad business model. Lawyers are not necessarily great managers. Outside investors, similarly, sometimes fail. But one can expect outside investors to demand better accountability and better organizational practice. Allowing that kind of discipline would be in the interests of both the lawyers and the clients that they serve. In short, I believe the time has come to allow non-lawyer investors to provide equity capital to law firms. That step will be irrelevant to many lawyers, and should be, but it will be beneficial to many lawyers' clients. It's possible, even common today, to have a law firm in which there's only one lawyer who holds all the equity, and all the other lawyers in the firm are employees. I'm arguing that a firm of Warren Buffett and Associates, not that Mr. Buffett has proposed that, but such a firm should be equally possible. And I'm suggesting that it would be at least equally concerned about its reputation and equally likely to be trustworthy. Now, in reality, one can predict that it's likely to be hard to get investors to pay as much for law firm shares as they are probably worth. Another ethical standard forbids lawyers that raise capital today from leaving the law firm tomorrow, with the investors holding the bag. Further, firm financial disclosures will have to take account of important concerns for confidentiality of client information and even identity. Those concerns are not trivial, but they are not insurmountable, given the right of law firms to provide such information to auditors today, and for auditors to send their own reports to banks or others who provide loans to law firms even now. There are proposals for more limited outside ownership, more analogous to the D.C. rule that requires majority lawyer ownership in law firms and says that non-lawyer owners must play an active role in the firm. I'm not proposing that either, but the point we are discussing today is whether there should continue to be a complete prohibition of non-lawyer ownership in firms that provide legal services. I believe, for the reasons I've suggested, that the answer to that question should be no. Now it's my pleasure to turn this discussion over to John Thies, who I suspect will have a somewhat different view.
Well, thank you, Professor Morgan, and I also want to thank the Society for having this debate. I think it is an interesting issue, and I especially want to commend Professor Morgan for bringing a lot of these questions to light. He's right. I do have a number of disagreements to the things that he said just a moment ago. First of all, by way of my background, as was mentioned, I'm president of the Illinois State Bar Association, We are a 32,000 member state bar, one of the largest voluntary bars in the country. I'm also president of the National Caucus of State Bar Associations. Our members collectively meet an enormous amount of the legal needs throughout our country. Now, I respectfully appreciate those who earnestly seek to expand the delivery of legal services. That's what we're all about at state bar associations and beyond, I know. But the answer is not to relax our ethical standards and permit greater influence by non-lawyers that aren't constrained by our code of ethics. There is so much potential for mischief when you interject individuals whose first motivation is to profits and not to serving the client interest. Permitting non-lawyer ownership of law firms would be a substantial and radical change over our current system. By way of background, non-lawyer ownership is currently prohibited by the Model Code of Professional Conduct. As Professor Morgan said, the only U.S. jurisdiction to permit non-lawyer ownership is the District of Columbia, and there is an absence of much evidence about their experience. Thus, the question is whether changes should be made to the code to permit this. Our State Bar Association believes that we should not make these changes and that non-lawyer involvement in the practice of law is a bad thing for a number of reasons. First, the stated need for non-lawyer ownership is suspect. The delivery of legal services is generally not capital intensive. And while it is true that our profession could do a better job at meeting the legal needs of middle and lower income individuals, the Walmart model comes at a price that is too high to pay. There are better ways to lower the cost of practicing law, which would make increased levels of service possible. Second, the benefit of non-lawyer ownership is questionable. Most lawyers will not benefit, and more importantly, the broad strokes of the proposal jeopardize the public interest. At least in the UK, the experience does not appear to be entirely positive. It is certainly too early to deem the UK and Australian experience as a success. Third, in contrast, the negative consequences of non-lawyer ownership could easily be significant. The core values of the profession are and should be embodied in the Code of Professional Conduct. These core values have stood the test of time for the benefit of the public and the legal profession. These include loyalty to clients, competence in the law, and independence from outside pressure that would influence our representation of clients. These are qualities that set us apart from non-lawyers and make us a profession and not a business devoted to bottom line profit. These principles have been the bedrock of law practice. Lawyers practice as a profession to serve the law and the citizens of the communities in which they practice. Non-lawyer ownership would remove the concept of a profession entirely. Gone would be the pure goal of service. Service would be replaced by making the basis for every decision connected with law practice, whether it is profitable in a monetary sense. The model rules are intended to be uniform. Thus, changes in the model rules, if adopted by a particular state, would apply to all lawyers, whether they're in a 1,000-person firm or a 5-person firm. Fourth, introducing non-lawyers into ownership threatens much greater government regulation of the practice of law. Because non-lawyers are not subject to a code of ethics, legislatures or non-judicial entities might seek to regulate the practice to protect the public. And if this happens, it will be much more difficult for us to resist these sorts of threats to lawyer independence, which is a very important thing. The public is much better served by the current system, which gives our courts authority over the practice of law. This allows lawyers to shape their professional norms, to be responsive to lawyers' practical experiences, and to serve the public good by teaching and guiding members of the profession. In conclusion, ours is a noble profession. Maintaining its integrity doesn't happen by accident. I believe that bar leaders should be vigilant against efforts to co-opt this profession for commercial gains. We are a profession and not a business. Non-lawyer involvement in the practice of law is a challenge to this. Thank you very much, and now I will turn it over to Francis Minton.
and thank you very much. Let me start by introducing myself a little. Dean mentioned that I am a partner at the law firm Wilkie Farr & Gallagher, and my specialty in my practice is commercial litigation. But what he did not mention is that I'm also the head of the conflicts and ethics function at this law firm and have been for about 15 years now. So that means I get to be the guy who makes the calls on whether we can or cannot do particular pieces of business due to ethical issues, generally conflicts. And that's given me quite a bit of insight into the over the years into the kind of circumstances that that lead to ethical quandaries for lawyers on a regular basis. Having said that, I find the issue that we're talking about today, public ownership of law firms, to be an odd one. It's clearly an issue that generates a good deal of controversy in the profession. The ABA has run up the flagpole a number of different proposals in this area over the course of the last about decade or so, all of which have been shot down to considerable controversy in the ranks. But I must say I'm a skeptic on both sides of the issue. I'm skeptical about the pros, and I'm also skeptical about the cons as they're put forward. And my ultimate conclusion is I like the idea of having a DC model and a UK model and an Australia model now all in effect and playing themselves out, and will play themselves out over the course of the next several years for us to get a good idea of where this all is going to go. Let me start with something that may not be obvious to everybody. Professional services firms that are able to go public, if they have good revenue, can be extremely valuable things. Outside the area of law and accounting, where firms by their professional rules are not allowed to go public, many consulting and professional services firms do go public, and there are a number of very well-known and large examples, and we can see from them that they tend to trade at a market cap in the range of 1 to 2 times revenue. Some of the more successful ones closer to two. I mean, perhaps the most obvious example, Accenture has revenues of around $30 billion, market cap of over $50 billion. So that's about a 1.7 revenue to market cap ratio. Towers Watson, a big consulting firm in the actuarial and pension area, has revenue of about $3.5 to $4 billion, a market cap approaching $6 billion. And there are many other firms. FTI is one lawyers might be familiar with because they provide expert witnesses in a lot of cases. Their revenue is about $1.5 billion. Their market cap's about $1.5 billion. Apply this to law firms, which, by the way, the American Lawyer did in an issue just a few months ago, and you realize that some of the major law firms could have market caps of well in excess of $1 billion. The highest that the American Lawyer came up with was about $5 billion for Kirkland & Ellis, and you realize that lawyers in these firms, if they could take their firms public, some of the top people could have paydays in the $30, $50, and even $100 million range. I was somewhat impressed by Tom Morgan's very principled free market arguments. I've always suspected that some of the pressure for going public comes from these people who could have very, very large paydays, one-time paydays. Firm can only go public once. And that's obviously a place where some of the pressure for this comes from. And I think that, as you've seen with other consulting firms, like in the Accenture's area or the pension consulting area, as soon as firms like this can go public, they start doing it. Not all at once, not in a rush, because it's a one-time sale event that a group of leaders will tend to do at the end of their career, but they will do it, and you'll find over a period of 10 or 20 or 30 years, maybe as many as half of the major firms could go public if it was allowed. Now, what let me then go over the pros and cons as they've been advanced by Tom and by John, and I'll tell you why I'm skeptical of most or all of them. But on the other hand, I'm not sure we can completely perceive what all the pros and cons are, which is why I think having the Australia and England particularly models out there playing out will be very valuable for us to see where to go. On the pro side, being a partner in a law firm, I do not perceive there is a capital shortage or a cash crisis in the legal profession. In this business, you rent an office, you buy a computer, you're in business. Even the major law firms have capital requirements, which are in the hundreds of thousands of dollars per partner, but given the size of the business, it's really pretty minimal and no problem for them to raise. Yes, some firms do get into trouble, but that's, I think, not going to be any different if they're public than currently. In terms of a lack of lawyers serving a middle-class market, I really perceive that to be not a capital problem, but a revenue problem. Nobody's figured out that good a revenue model. Now, Tom makes a perfectly good point about LegalZoom, and are they really being crippled by not going public? I mean, the ads of them that I see have they say they refer you to lawyers. Tom says it's cumbersome. It may be. If so, that is a downside that I recognize. I'm not convinced that it's really a major downside in terms of restricting access of the public to legal services. I say Tom's presentation was very principled free market. I will ask the question, and I put this as a partner of a major law firm who may have some interest, but why shouldn't we be able to sell out and make a lot of money? Lots of my friends who've been in business have sold out and made a lot of money, and I have an enormously successful business with which doesn't have $1 of sale value, and when I leave, I just lose it. I guess I'm prepared to do that, but I don't know that we should be embarrassed about arguing that the right to sell a business is such a terrible thing. On the con side, as I hear everything that John says, and I'm a big believer in appropriate ethics for law firms, but I really am not convinced that the decisions that we make, certainly at a firm like this, on conflicts would really be very different if instead of having what's called ethical rules and deeming ourselves to be a different kind of human being that operates on a different plane from the rest of humanity, if what we simply had were the regular rules that apply to all businesses and the same set of cases that the courts already have, I'm very hard-pressed to come up with a decision on conflicts that we would make differently than the way we make it now. Just as an example, in the United States, we have the rule that a lawyer or law firm cannot sue a current client on any matter, no matter how unrelated it is to anything you do for that client. In Europe, they don't have that rule. In Europe, as an ethical matter, you can sue your current client on a matter that's unrelated to what you do for them as an ethical matter. Well, do you see European law firms regularly suing their current clients? It does happen, but it's quite common and quite uncommon and quite rare. Why? Well, if you sue your current client, they'll fire you. They'll fire you from everything else you're doing. Well, you might say, how about if the current client is a very small client and the new client is a very big client? Wouldn't you fire or sue your current client in those circumstances? And there may well be instances in the absence of an ethical rule where people would do it, but I would point out that business reputation, in the absence of any ethical rule, just for a business as opposed to a lawyer, is a very, very important thing. The kind of thing firing your client to sue them is the kind of thing that gets around, not only gets around, I mean, clients would have every incentive and clearly would make a very public stink about it. So even in the absence of ethical rules, I don't see that happening with any frequency, let alone, of course, there are court rules that prevent you from doing it. Many on this call may be familiar with the so-called hot potato doctrine that prevents a law firm from firing a client in order to make it a non-client so that you can sue it. Courts enforce that by disqualification. And in the absence of calling things rules of ethics in the world of public law firms, why shouldn't that rule still apply? The most persuasive argument I heard from John is the greater government regulation argument. And the truth is that the legal profession is quite free of federal regulation at this time. And at the state level, we don't have a lot of specific regulation directed towards us other than through the court system and the ethical rule process, which is a relatively sane process compared to what many other businesses deal with at multiple levels. So in conclusion, for me, where do I see the public, if public ownership were allowed, what do I foresee? I would foresee, number one, I would foresee a trend of the largest firms going public slowly over time. But it could be a lot of them over a course of decades, maybe as many as half of them over a 20 or 30 year period, if looking to the experience of consulting firms. I would not see any significant change in the availability of legal services to the poor and middle class. I think that is a revenue problem rather than a capital problem. I could be proved wrong by the England and Australia models. I don't think I will be. I do not see a real significant difference in terms of how law firms would deal with conflicts between whether they're public or private. And fourth, I mean, I'll throw a new consideration in, but would being public somewhat degrade client focus, which would be significant not as an ethical matter, I think, but maybe as a competitive matter or a business matter for law firms? Would a public firm be at a somewhat competitive disadvantage because it's more overtly focused on profitability rather than a client focus? That's an issue very hard to predict. You haven't really seen it affecting the consulting firms that much, but it could be an issue going forward. Thank you.
Terrific. This is Dean Reuter again, and we're talking about public ownership of law firms. We just listened to Francis Menton, who said a lot that I think probably Professor Tom Morgan and maybe even John Thies want to reply to. Before we do that and before we open the floor to questions, let me make a very quick programming announcement. We have two more Teleform calls on the schedule for the remainder of the week. This Thursday at 2 p.m., we'll be talking with Judge Randall Rader and Professor Adam Mossoff about the state of the patent system. That is Thursday at 2 p.m. Then on Friday at noon, we'll be talking with a panel of experts about the Pentagon and the NSA and their roles in policing domestic cybersecurity and what restrictions might operate in their attempts to police domestic cybersecurity. That's Friday at noon. And please do look for an announcement of an upcoming, I think, very special Teleform conference call that's likely to take place on Monday of next week, April 15th, at 4 p.m., when we'll be talking about a new project of the Federalist Society that we're launching. Professor Tom Morgan, let me see if either you or John Thies, if you want to respond to anything you heard by any of the later commenters, you can take a minute or two to do so.
Dean, I'd like to, this is Tom Morgan, I'd like to just jump in and deal first with John Thies's point about the profession-business distinction. I think Francis Minton responded to that pretty effectively, but what I'd suggest is that we are both a profession and a business. We have to be successful as a business in order to be able to deliver the kind of service and indeed even the kind of pro bono service that many firms provide. You don't get very far by simply drawing that line. My assumption is that the legal services that are being delivered by any of the firms we're talking about, regardless of who owns them, would be subject to the restrictions that exist on any law firm. Second, it is true that we don't have experience yet, or substantial experience, from Great Britain and Australia, but the experience we do have is that the organizations that have initially been created under that system have been disproportionately aimed at the poor and middle class. It has not been primarily the big firms. This has not primarily been a financial issue. It has been a legal services issue. That may not be true over the long haul. Will remains to be seen. In D.C., we have had this system for some time, a little different than the one in Britain and Australia, and it has not produced any of the negatives that John Thies and other critics of the proposal have suggested. Finally, on this point about regulation, my concern is that you can't hold the world constant and simply say, let's go for 10 years and see how these various systems develop, and then we'll decide then what the rule ought to be. The reality is that groups like LegalZoom, and there are a variety of others coming up with new and different ways to deliver legal service, they're going to be out there, they're going to be acting, and the regulation is at least as likely, in fact, in my view, more likely to occur and to increase when you have a world in which you don't have the delivery of legal services under the control of the courts as it has been for several hundred years. What I'm really proposing is that the courts get out ahead of the reality, that they that they change the rules, that they watch the developments, and that they retain the kind of regulation, which I think all three speakers agree, has been preferable to the kind of regulation we could expect out of Congress or state legislatures or anything of the kind.
John Thies, do you want to respond?
Yeah, I've got a few comments. First of all, clearly my interest is not in supporting a big payday for mega firm lawyers. As Tom said, it is unusual that we have these enormous situations. It's not that it doesn't happen. We certainly do have mega firms who would be positioned to be like the reference to Kirkland & Ellis and their $5 billion payday, perhaps, but that really is not my focus. I think that giving too much attention to that really is at the expense of meeting the legal needs of the vast majority of citizens of the country. LegalZoom, of course, denies that they provide legal service. They would stand on they're providing forms. While there may be a perception from people watching their commercials that that's not what they do, they're very careful to say they're not practicing law. So to take it to the next level with them really does open the door to regulation, because in most places the Supreme Courts are not willing to regulate non-lawyers. They will regulate lawyers but there's a tension there about whether they are willing to regulate those that are not licensed to practice law. So the LegalZoom situation I don't see that as solving our problem, because I see that as leading to much more regulation down the road. In Illinois, for example, we have the sale of a law firm. It has to be to a lawyer, but we have a sale of a law firm. That's something that my state bar association worked hard to accomplish. And so to suggest that people are not able to sell their firms, if you're at a larger firm, I'm at a 10-person firm, you can sell your interest to others in the firm, and that's a function of the agreement with your partners. If you're a solo, that new rule means that they too are in a position to sell their interest. It's not for the billions of dollars that we're talking about with the big firms, but it's a lot of money to a lot of solo practitioners around who care very deeply about that. We don't want the Wild West, and that's where we would head in terms. That's what would lead us to greater and greater regulation and interference by legislatures, and that's something that I try very hard to avoid to every extent possible. The ABA, as was mentioned by Francis Menton, has looked at this a number of times over the years. Most recently, through the activities of the Task Force Ethics 2020, where they had floated proposals on both non-lawyer ownership and the issue of fee splitting, both inter-firm and intra-firm. And there was a resounding rejection of those proposals that they either withdrew them or they chose not to proceed with them to the House of Delegates because of the outcry. I think the vast majority of members of our profession would be against the idea of going forward, and that is because of this point about are we a profession or are we a business. And finally, my understanding is that there's been a recent incident in the UK where one of these organizations was actually closed because of problems that followed from the new rules that permitted non-lawyer ownership. I don't know very much about that. I expect Tom Morgan may know more about it, but I think based on things like stories like that and interaction I've had with those practicing in the UK, it has not been uniformly embraced, and I do think it is interesting to watch how those entities are doing as time goes on.
And Francis Menton, do you have anything you want to add before we go to the audience for questions?
Well, maybe I'll add just a couple of sentences. On that last point, John didn't mention what the entity was, but I'm a little bit dubious only in that here in lovely New York, if you read our law journal, you'll find probably on about a weekly basis some horror story of a lawyer who has gone berserk or stolen the client funds or whatever. So just having ethical rules doesn't mean that people are necessarily going to follow them. And I'll hold out a level of dubiousness on the question of was it really a consequence of a public ownership versus human nature that applies as well to lawyers as others.
Can I respond quickly to that?
Okay. Yeah.
Just that when it happens to the person that you read about it in New York, who's the lawyer that runs afoul, we have ethical guidelines and we have procedures that allow us to discipline that lawyer. That is not true with respect to non-lawyers.
Fair enough. And I can't say I know what the procedure is in England. I mean, the other very brief remark I wanted to make is your reference to it would be the Wild West. I am basically in favor of capitalism, and you could call it the Wild West, but it basically works. So you need to have a good reason for an exception. That's it.
Very good. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. If you have a question for any of our experts at that point, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone, and we'll take the questions in the order in which they're received. Our lines are open. We don't have any questions pending at this point. The star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you'd like to join the conversation. while we're waiting to see if the audience rings in with questions, let me ask a question. Is there any concern? I mean, I heard that, the investment by outside parties in law firms would make legal services in some ways more efficient or more available to more people. Is there any concern that there'll be an explosion of litigation, that with investors behind law firms, if you tend more towards a business model and a bottom line move for profit, that it will foment litigation, increase litigation?
Dean, this is Tom Morgan. I would suggest to you we already have that, and it's illustrative of my point that you've got to be ahead of these developments instead of behind them. What's happening today is that people are investing in litigation. They're investing both in supporting plaintiffs in litigation, in lending money for a share of their recovery. They're buying the cases, the defense cases, are providing support to a defendant, and in exchange for a share calculated in some way, and thus sustaining litigation in a way that I think is expressed in your question. That wasn't particularly the topic of this panel, but it's illustrative of the fact that non-lawyers and investors are getting involved in things that used to be the exclusive province of lawyers, and unless and until we get ahead of these developments, we're going to have difficulty. If I could just add one additional point, John Thies is correct that the courts only regulate lawyers today, but what happens in Britain and Australia is that they regulate not only lawyers, but also entities, that is, entities as firms. And what happened in the UK, and I'm not an expert on the particular case, but as I remember, the UK regulatory authority found that this firm was not operating consistent with the rules, I believe it was financial rules in that case, and stepped in and closed down that entity. So there is disciplinary authority in Britain and Australia, and it's illustrative of the kind of thing I was suggesting, that is, if you get the courts out ahead of the matter, then you get them in control of the range of activities and regulate them consistently across the board rather than having some regulated and some unregulated.
Mr. Thies or Mr. Minton, you want to weigh in on this point before we do have a couple audience questions pending.
Francis Minton here, and briefly on your question, Dean, about would there be an explosion of litigation if public ownership is allowed? I can't see it. My point is that if a given line of business has revenue associated with it, there's no shortage of capital now. I don't see it as a capital problem. And just illustrative of that, if you are the co-head of a business litigation group at a large law firm like me, you've lived long enough to have the following happen. You are approached by a hedge fund who says to you, if you want to take business if you have business that looks profitable but can only be taken on by you on a contingency basis, show it to us. If we like the revenue prospects, we'll pay your hourly rates and in return for taking the contingency if you win. So that's out there even today, for those who don't know it, as a capital-raising device where the revenue is available. Now, that applies to lucrative contingency cases, not to legal services for the poor and middle class.
Mr. Thies, did you want to add?
This is John Thies. What I was going to respond to was the point about regulation. It's not my view that you couldn't regulate non-lawyers who are involved. It's the difficulty in keeping that regulation, that process to the courts. We are continually wrestling with legislatures across the country that would like to play a greater role in the regulation of the practice of law. and you have courts that are resistant to taking on that regulatory process, for example, in connection with the unauthorized practice of law, I know there's at least one because Illinois now is doing it. There may be other states that are agreeing to regulate the unauthorized practice of law when a non-lawyer is involved. So it's possible, but it's just more difficult to have our current approach, which is a good approach, where our courts are the ones regulating the practice of law. It's hard to be confident that would continue as to the non-lawyers.
We've got a couple audience question callers with questions, so why don't we go to our first caller question.
Hi, very interesting discussion. Are there any published research on how this has been working out in the jurisdictions that are allowing it?
This is John Thies. I know that we have looked for evidence of the experience of D.C. In connection with the deliberations at the ABA. Tom Morgan probably has a better feel for that than I do, but I can just say that it was very difficult to get information about how frequently this model was being used in the District of Columbia and what the experience was.
Well, I don't have statistics on it, as Tom Morgan, as to how often it's used, but it's been principally used in, as I understand it, with firms that have government relations practices and admit people who have had substantial government experience, frequently elective experience, who then join a law firm once they leave office. There has been no issue of any kind of the kinds of horrors that are predicted generally with respect to the sale of stock in firms. On the other hand, I would have to acknowledge that it's not a test case on the model of Great Britain or Australia. But the fact that there's very little information is just evidence of the fact that it's not been a problem.
This is Francis Menton. What might be of interest to you, I mean, somebody got me for preparing for this, a report by the New York State Bar Association that's pretty recent, November 17, 2012. I know they got it by Googling on the web, so it shouldn't be too hard to find. It's called Report of the Task Force on Non-Lawyer Ownership, and it includes some substantial review of the situation in D.C., the U.K., and Australia, including how they got there, but it ultimately does not – it does have some citations and references, so you could follow them, but there is not a lot of experience in the U.K. and Australia changes are – they're more than a year old. They're a few years old, but there's not a lot of experience at this point.
I know a little bit of background on that New York report, Francis. I know that they interviewed some, I think more than one UK person to learn of their experience. And my recollection is that report was not in favor of non-lawyer ownership.
Oh, this New York State Bar Association report is extremely negative on non-lawyer ownership, but I think, to be fair, Illinois Bar is in the same place, and I think most of the bar associations are there. I mean, I think Tom Morgan perhaps fairly makes the point that should this be looked on as the lawyers trying to protect the public or trying to feather their own nest, and that's appropriate skepticism to have, I think.
Well, let me just give you an example. Representing a lot of people that work in smaller firm settings, I can just imagine sitting around the table deciding about whether you're going to settle a case. And on the one hand, you've got the concern to reward your shareholder who's clamoring for a dividend, who's not a lawyer, not bound by a code of ethics. And on the other hand, the lawyer that is driven first and foremost by the interest of the client. there's a tension there that is really a recipe for disaster.
If you'd like to join the conversation, you need to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got one pending question, and our lines will be open. Let's go to our next caller.
Thank you to each of the speakers. An observation and then a question. The observation is that the idea that duty to shareholders is inconsistent with a code of ethics or a duty to customers or clients is one that I find contrary to the evidence and contrary to experience. The idea that owing a duty to the shareholders means that one doesn't and can't effectively owe a duty to customers or even clients is one I think there's nothing behind that, and I speak in this case as somebody who works in-house and in some ways has those kind of duties already. Now to my question. I would ask, what is the distinction between debt holders and equity holders in this case for the people who are opposed to equity ownership of law firms? Owning debt of a law firm can be just as much the crack of a whip for business results, perhaps sometimes more, because of where in line the debt holders stand in relation to equity holders in a typical situation of who gets paid first. If debt holding has evils to it that are the same as these, should we be looking to get rid of the allowance to buy debt of law firms, or does that suggest that perhaps the fears are overblown?
Well, I think to practice law, the code is full of requirements that you need to do it in a financially sound way, and so I think as long as you're going to have to satisfy whatever debt you owe, and so long as you do that, you won't have pressure from the debt holder. In contrast, there are obligations to equity holders, and you are faced with that potential conundrum, because I know how that it's tough enough when a lawyer is bound by a code of ethics to make that decision of even though it's not in the client's interest to settle the case today, it might be in your own financial interest. And I think lawyers have done a really good job at resisting the temptation to settle when they shouldn't, to put it off because it's not in the client's interest. So I do see a distinction between the two situations, though I'm mindful that the fact that you owe debt can result in pressure on the practice, but I think that it is less pressure than you would feel if you had non-lawyers that had equity interests in your firm.
All right, let's take what looks to be our final question at this point. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone.
Hi, this is Bill Hodes calling. I wanted to return to the issue that a lot of people have touched on about whether there would be more or less or regulation and whether that would be a bad thing. It seems to me that it doesn't follow either for LegalZoom or for anybody else that if it was in fact a law firm, whatever it was, and that was allowed to have non-lawyers in it, doesn't follow that the non-lawyers would be subject to other regulations. I think you could structure it, and my assumption always was that because the entity in which they're investing is still a law firm, is and the legal services themselves can only be provided by lawyers, that the regulation, the ethical regulation, and the other regulations of lawyers and law firms would be the same as it always was, and the fact that the person who owns an equity share can't be disciplined doesn't mean that the lawyer who supposedly is being pressured by this person is not going to be regulated. In fact, he'll be regulated the same, and he'll be saying, "No, we're not doing this, Mr. Shareholder, because we're a law firm, and that's one of the things we can't do." Because I'm not going to give up my license just to settle this case. So I again agree with those who said that it's overblown. I agree that it's an important issue. We do not want the regulation of lawyers to go outside of the courts, but I don't think this would lead to that.
This is John. At least you may be directing that at me. I agree with that point. It certainly wouldn't or shouldn't preclude the regulation of the lawyers, but the problem is that you've got the non-lawyers to consider as well. And my point before was just that it would not necessarily be an easy thing to regulate them under the current model.
This is Tom Morgan. People all the time buy shares in regulated firms, whether they're banks or any of hundreds of kinds of regulated firms, and they buy them subject to the regulation. And if the firm, the company violates its regulations, the investors get hurt. And while they may in the short run say that they want you to push the limits, you've got to run the organization consistent with your regulatory structure. And that's and I think that the point Bill Hodes is making and Francis Menton and that I've tried to make is that what I'm advocating is that we get the courts out ahead of these problems, make them the regulators of the entities that are delivering legal services in addition to the lawyers that are delivering those services. And in doing that, we're likely to have the most effective regulatory structure that we could have in this area.
Well, gentlemen, it appears that we're out of time. We have a couple minutes left. We're out of questions at this point. Let me see if any of you want to take 30 seconds or so to wrap up, express any final thoughts, and why don't we suggest we do that in the same order we had our opening remarks. Professor Tom Morgan, do you have a final thought?
First, I'd like to thank my colleagues and thank the questioners. I think this has been a good discussion of a complex and often misunderstood topic. And I hope that we've brought out the relevant issues. I wouldn't say that the current regulation is solely designed to protect lawyers, but I think that it is it behooves all of us who are lawyers to think about whether or not the fact that we have been successful under the current model means we can afford not to consider what changes in the model might do to benefit our current clients and future clients who we're not now serving.
John Thies.
Yes, I also want to thank everybody for their participation, especially my colleagues and the Federal Society for putting this together. I agree with Tom Morgan that these are very important questions for us to be exploring. There are a number of threats to the delivery of legal service, and we could spend other sessions like this on these and go through them. But I think this is one that we have a track record over the last 15 years or so, where from time to time the issue of getting more and more non-lawyers involved in the practice of law has come up, and there's a reason why it continues to be rejected, and that is, in those instances where we've seen similar things, such as the Enron debacle, where you had auditors with a different interest than the consultants, that has provided evidence that this sort of thing that we're discussing today, would not be good for the delivery of legal service.
And a final thought from Francis Menton.
Well, I think I'm just going to thank everyone for participating and say how much I appreciated the others' remarks. I don't think I have anything to add at this point that wouldn't be duplicative of what was just said.
Very good. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, this is Dean Reuter. I want to thank Professor Thomas Morgan, Mr. John Thies, and Mr. Francis Menton for joining us today and for sharing your thoughts with us. We certainly appreciate this. To the audience, I invite you to join our next Teleforum conference call Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number, when we'll be discussing the state of the patent system. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org /multimedia.